Warm Regards is brought to you by Arcadia Power, the first company to offer a nationwide community solar program. Whether you live in an apartment or a house in California or Kentucky, you can now get solar savings with Arcadia Power anywhere. Arcadia's online platform allows anyone who pays a power bill to subscribe to solar panels from projects across the country and get savings on their monthly bill. Learn more about Arcadia's community solar program and find out how much you can save at arcadiapower.com/solar. That's arcadiapower.com/solar.
Hey everybody, this is Warm Regards, a dialogue between the climate scientists, newsmakers, journalists, and people on the front lines of climate change. I'm Eric Holthaus here in Tucson, Arizona. We've got a quick announcement. This episode will be the last in what we're calling Season 1 of Warm Regards. We've had a tremendously positive response to the podcast so far, from you, our listeners, and from the larger podcast community. We've had a lot of ideas on where to go from here. We're very open to hearing your feedback on what has worked and what hasn't so far. We feel like we've quickly grown something very special here, and we want to make sure our next steps are the right ones. We are just getting started. Okay, so for today, we're going to run down the four biggest climate stories of the year, as voted on by that ultimate arbiter of truth, Twitter. I posted a poll this morning, and no kidding, in about 2 hours, more than 700 of you voted. So we will talk about these stories in the order that they were ranked by you guys. To help me with this year in review of the global climate system in 2016, I am joined as always by Jacqueline Gill, a paleoecologist at the University of Maine, and Andy Revkin, a freshly minted senior reporter on climate change at ProPublica. How did your first week go, Andy?
Busy, busy, busy. And like Jacqueline, I'm still, I got my feet in my other academic role for the next couple of weeks. So juggling grading students' work and getting stories, first stories finished here is always interesting. But it's a great, what's so cool here is it's kind of like special ops. Everyone in the 60 people or so, and they're all kind of like creme de la creme and unbelievably focused on really important questions, financial rights issues and pollution, and with me, climate change. It's kind of exciting, so stay tuned.
Kind of exciting. That doesn't sound very exciting.
Too busy to be excited.
I'd be interested to know just really quickly, what is it like being in a newsroom again? Like, how are you assigned stories? What is your morning process like to define what you're doing that day, just really quickly?
Well, they can't possibly respond to the daily flow. There's so many good reporters out there focused on climate and energy and bloggers that here it's more about picking shots and looking for those deeper threads that are beneath the kind of constant flow. They're getting more engaged in having content that's fresh for the day, but it's really not the strength. It's an investigative outfit, and the whole idea here is to do the deep digging that other media can't afford to do anymore. And it was wonderful that John Oliver gave us a shout out on his first post-election show. It is a place to support if you want to maintain quality, in-depth reporting. And so it isn't really like, oh my God, someone just beat us on Twitter. And you know, for me, the biggest change is the biorhythm change after 2,810 .earth posts in 9 years to thinking deeper. I've done a couple of magazine pieces this past year, but this will be the new norm for me. And leaving .earth behind has been sort of a sad feeling, but also, I don't have to check comments tonight.
So joining us as a special guest this week to talk about our first story is Kim Cobb, a climate scientist at Georgia Tech, who specializes in collecting and analyzing paleoclimate information from corals, caves, and the global water cycle. We brought her here specifically to talk about our first story, ranked number 4 by readers, but to me, the one with the most immediate impact for hundreds of millions of people around the world. This year has been a transformative one for Earth's coral reefs. A recent follow-up survey of the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, about 6 months after the peak bleaching earlier this year, showed about 22% of the reef's corals have died, including a tragic 67% in the northernmost part of the reef. Kim and her team have traveled twice this year to Christmas Island in a remote part of the Central Pacific to do surveys of her own and study in real time how corals there responded to the most intense El Nino on record. So Kim, first off, I want to just give you a chance to tell your story of what it was like during that first trip to Christmas earlier this year when you saw the corals just after the bleaching event. I mean, I spoke with you on the phone a few days later for a story for Think Progress, but the tone in your voice has really stuck with me those months later, that this was truly a transformative event.
Yes, it really was something that has taken the better part of the year to sink in, and something that I'd known about for the previous year leading up to this spring trip that we just took this year. We knew for a very long time that these corals were going to be under severe thermal stress. We saw the bleaching reports coming back from NOAA while we were still stuck here at Georgia Tech, watching temperatures rise to staggering levels, and knowing that the reef would be heavily impacted. But of course, intellectually knowing something and then getting out there and donning your scuba gear on a beautiful sunny morning and motoring out on a gorgeous day and dropping in the waters of a reef that you have known since you were a baby graduate student, corals that you've grown up with literally, and then to drop down and take a look at the reef and realize that your worst fears had come true, there's really no words for that experience. I was just shocked to try to reconcile in my brain what had been, you know, glimmers of hope and thinking that resilience, resilience is more abundant than we think in the ecosystems that are as complex as a coral reef. But it was incredibly sobering. And of course, going back again this November, 6 months after our initial surveys of the devastation, and realizing that there's no coming back from the dead. And somehow you still hope that you may go back and see things will be better than you last saw them. And it's not. And it's very clear, especially on this return trip that we just made last month, that this is going to be a very, very, very long haul. And of course, it's not just Christmas. It's the Great Barrier Reef and many other reef systems around the world that were hit by these temperature extremes.
One thing that was really striking for me is, you know, Kim, you and I have, you know, we're in similar fields, right? We're kind of both reconstructing past environments and ecological responses to those changes. But one thing that was really striking for me was, like, I don't get to really see my study system in the same way that you do, right? You've got these amazing coral reef systems that are both an incredible archive of, you know, thousands or in some cases millions of years of change. But it's not like I get to go outside and check on, like, the mammoths every year, you know, and like fly like helicopter into the Arctic and just see, like, oh yeah, the mammoth populations are doing really well. So for you to just have this incredible visceral experience seeing firsthand how right now is different must have been so powerful, and not necessarily in a good way.
Yeah, I mean, that's really difficult when it comes home to roost, something that you've been working on in rocks, basically, right? I mean, I reconstruct past ocean temperatures in rocks that have been lying around on beaches for decades and centuries and millennia for the bulk of my work. That's my niche. That's what I do, working with fossil corals, stretching back into time periods that are relevant for both of us. But when I go to look at the modern reef, I've approached it over my career as an opportunity to calibrate. I put temperature sensors on the reef. I try to learn how climate comes down into an individual colony from changes in ocean chemistry and changes in ocean temperature. And that's why I got my scuba license, to serve my scientific purpose in calibrating my reconstructions. And as this event started wrapping up, I realized with scientific greed that this would be an opportunity of a lifetime to ground truth one of these elusive climate extremes in really real time. And so we ran out there and peppered the reef with a huge number of sensors and waited for it to go down. And then came the grim reality that this was perhaps larger than we had anticipated. And then, of course, layers of realization that your very archive that you use to capture past ocean temperatures will be crippled in a very real-time, modern-day sense, and that more to the point, you, in servicing your environmental sensors, are going to come face-to-face with that fact in a very, very real and inescapable way. So again, this very interesting experience of moving from an intellectual, scientifically-driven pursuit to a gut punch was something I don't recommend. But on the other hand, it has transformed my research program. I think it really has challenged me to make sure that my research is the most relevant that it can be to this. I've had huge numbers of students reach out to me saying, I want to help the reefs. And I'm trying to meet that demand by making tweaks to my research program and seeking out new collaborations. So that's been interesting and challenging at the same time.
Can you really quickly describe for us how corals work and how they lay down that record of ocean temperature?
Yeah. So corals obviously take seawater and through mechanisms involving their internal chemistry changes, lay down a skeleton of calcium carbonate. And they do this very, very quickly. So they lay that skeleton down anywhere from 5 millimeters a year up to 20 millimeters a year, sometimes more.
And that's the rock, right?
Yeah, that's the base of the coral. That's basically the basis of a coral colony. That's what we see, actually, is the structure that the corals have built as their home. And then the living coral animals are really present on only the outermost skin of what most of us would call a piece of coral. And it's on this thin veneer of coral tissue that you have the organism living in symbiosis with these photosynthetic algae and making a living and making a home for itself in the process. And so what we do when we take advantage of the coral skeleton is we use the fact that they grow outwards at pretty quick rates, so much like you would look at a tree ring, for example, except in the case of the coral records, we're looking at the chemical variations in the coral skeleton that it has laid down. And this you can prove in many laboratory settings. Is really a strong function of ocean temperatures at the time that the coral laid down that skeleton, that calcium carbonate skeleton. And so we can use those past variations that have been accreted through time in a case of the living reef that you can scuba dive in and see on the modern oceans. You're looking at 100 years of record at most in most reef environments for a living coral colony on any given reef today. And then, of course, most of my work has pushed that horizon back by looking at long dead corals that are littered around ocean-facing beaches at these atoll sites that have been deposited there over decades and centuries and millennia. And by using radioactive dating techniques, we can figure out when these corals grew. And we apply the same kind of chemical analysis to those older material that we do to the living material on the reef, and thereby push this horizon of ocean temperature reconstruction back much further, in our case, as much as 7,000 years at Christmas Island.
So how certain are you that what has happened this year is unique in that 7,000-year record?
Well, we have had whopper El Niño events, single events in the past. I think the largest single event that we have documented in our record, and I'm talking about from a pre-El Niño event to a peak event to a post-El Niño year, so just over 3 years, the largest departure we have had occurred in the early 17th century as a single event. But of course, when you look at the changes in extremes, you don't just want to look at one event and whether this is strictly unprecedented or not to determine a climate change role. What you really need to do is look at the statistics of these extreme events. And that's exactly what we do when we look at El Niños locked in the coral record. So we look at El Niño activity recorded in the pre-industrial era in these coral records. And then we compare that to El Niño activity as locked into the coral records in the late 20th century, of course, as well as captured by instrumental records. And that's when we're able to infer a statistically significant difference between pre-industrial and 20th century El Nino activity, suggesting that there is a role for climate change in this intensification that we see in the coral records.
And then you have one other factor, the acidification question on top of this on a long time scale as well, with still a lot of questions, I guess, about how that'll play out.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that's very, very hard to address from a coral record perspective, because, of course, as you have more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you warm the global oceans, and we all understand that. We can document that. And you also, of course, acidify the surface ocean by pure chemical reactions. And we can observe that as well in long records of ocean pH that have stretched back to the early 90s now. And from the coral perspective, there's still really important debates and science to be done around what is going to be the biggest near-term impact, which, of course, has implications for what we can do to assist coral reefs as they try to get through these next several decades. And I think this year would put a vote in the column of temperature stress being the largest near-term challenge for global reefs, and acidification being something that is going to start rearing its head probably in the mid-21st century.
Mm-hmm. So the basic chemistry equation here, just for everyone, is CO2 plus H2O equals carbonic acid. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And then gradually the carbonic acid tends to dissolve the anything that uses calcium as a source of shell.
Yeah, I think the issue is not that it's going to necessarily dissolve existing carbonates, but that it's going to impede the calcification of coral skeletons and the calcification of new coral polyps as they try to grow their homes on the reef. And of course, corals aren't the only calcifying organisms out there. We're talking about a lot of marine organisms that actively calcify. And so you're talking about potentially large swaths of ecosystems that are going to have a harder and harder time, basic function.
Yeah, so, plankton and snails and arthropods.
Yes,
and
exactly. Yeah, some of which are more susceptible than others. There's a lot of very important active areas of research around the impacts of ocean acidification. Some of it's occurring in laboratory environments. Some of it is occurring out there in the field and in special higher acidity environments. We're still chasing down those questions as a community, obviously very important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is why in the last year and a half or so, I mean, especially since I first met Jacqueline when I was working on that feature for Rolling Stone, it's really struck me how huge of a story the ocean is right now. Not only, as you mentioned, Kim, most of the warming on Earth is in the ocean in a pure heat content way. The pause that you were referencing was an atmospheric pause. It wasn't an ocean heat pause.
That's right.
So in the sense that almost all life on Earth is dependent on the ocean, and the stability of our climate system is dependent on the stability of the ocean. The ocean is the story right now, in my perspective, and I think the fact that, you know, for example, for my Twitter followers, at least, that it was ranked number four out of these four topics, it shows that hasn't really hit home yet for a lot of people, that the importance of the ocean. The ocean feels distant. It feels like something that you don't interact with very often, but it really underlies the entire climate system.
Yeah, I mean, its importance cannot be overstated, as you just outlined. Obviously, this awareness this year has come because people have an emotional connection to coral reefs. Many people have had some of the best moments of their lives on coral reefs, snorkeling around on reefs. So it hits people's hearts when you have an event like this. But ocean services go far beyond pretty snorkeling outings, really talking about storing vast quantities of heat, as you mentioned, and vast quantities of carbon dioxide that we've been putting in the atmosphere for a very long time. So from a carbon services perspective, it's really trying to ride us out of this problem as a global ocean. And so as a resource, that's another important thing to keep mm-hmm. in mind.
So let's move on to the next topic. Number three on the list was the Paris Accord became international law. So this was in the sense that there was a major success story on the global scale this year. This was it, really. There was unprecedented urgency, I think, in almost every nation on Earth to quickly transform this agreement made in Paris last year into an actual binding law that governs global emissions at the national scale. And, you know, there's a lot of flaws with Paris. It's a voluntary target. There's no real enforcement mechanism. The timelines for review are, I think the first timeline is 2022. And the aggregate of these pledges is not nearly enough to keep us below the 2°C agreed upon level. So there's a lot of problems with Paris, but it is something that we have never had before. And I think that that is the basis from here on out for any time that we reference climate action. Paris has to be a part of that conversation.
To me, Paris represented the biggest sea change was that the environmental community and kind of the UN community had forever seemed willing to jettison the imperfect for the ideal. And Paris was the final incarnation of a transformation to recognizing that the imperfect is the only thing you can get 196 countries into a room for, that you'll never get binding targets and timetables at a global scale. And that was such a giant change. It swung everything back to Rio. Rio was the same way back in 1991, 92, to the first Earth Summit and the first Framework Convention. And it's just the way forward is implicitly flawed and inadequate, but it's kind of the human way. And the best part of Paris, as I wrote in the Times, is it's created an architecture for a journey, and it's less focused on the destination, because it's the first acknowledgement in the treaty process that this is a journey and not about an endpoint that someone can police.
Yeah, to me, the most important phrase in the Paris Agreement was that I think the wording was that by the second half of the 21st century, we'll agree to zero carbon or net zero carbon global economy. And that really is what we should all be striving for, is zero carbon as quickly as possible. It doesn't really matter how you get there. Of course, you want to get there in the most cost-efficient way possible with the least amount of sort of unintended negative consequences. You want to make sure that everyone, especially those people that are being hit hardest by climate change, are sort of have a voice in this process. Make sure that everyone is being listened to. But really, the ultimate goal is not a temperature target that is somewhat arbitrary and constantly changing, but it's zero carbon as quickly as possible.
So one thing I'm wondering, I know in a previous show we've talked about how Paris is in theory resilient to President Trump, but now I'm wondering how his election might be emboldening other conservative leaders. A senator in Australia just yesterday Corey Bernardi calling on Malcolm Turnbull to withdraw from Paris. And so I'm just wondering if Trump's election will have a cascading effect to other leaders that are also going through sort of similar reactionary periods in their own nations.
You know, Jacqueline, I was going to try to get through a whole episode without mentioning the T word, but...
Oh, I know. And I was the one who was like, we can't have the election be one of our four or one of our top stories of the year.
Oh, although it kind of is, you know.
I mean, how could it not be? On the other hand, it's...
From your perspective, Kim, how has sort of the election, or you? I mean, you work across nation. You work with other governments in some cases, in collaborations. From your perspective, how has the sort of election, and how has the Paris Accord sort of changed the conversation across the world?
Well, I mean, I can only speak to my personal digestion, which is ongoing and not very effective personally. I'm still in a good degree of shock. And I'm right now struggling to try to envision a role for, or a mechanism, I suppose, for other climate scientists to more meaningfully engage in what must be a strong, unified voice and mechanisms of clear input and engagement. So I'm very focused on the national stage right now. And I know that my colleagues are right at this moment in, I believe it's Marrakesh, talking about scoping the 1.5 degree C report. And so, in a sense, from my narrow view of climate science, the show goes on. We have a job to do. We will continue to do it, is very much the sentiment on the ground here. There's a process in place. We're all very meaningfully engaged in that process from a scientific perspective and as organized under the special reports that are emerging out of the UN, requests from Paris, basically. And that's extremely heartening. That kind of keeps me going. It doesn't change the fact that how climate science is conducted in the U.S. and how policy is shaped in the U.S. Will possibly be derailed for a matter of possibly even decades, which is a grave concern to me and something that I'm still turning over and thinking about ways to try to slow that that slide, basically, as a scientist. But it's a big challenge.
But it seems like that was sort of the feeling, the response, immediate response from the international community after the election was that, you know, it's like now we have Paris, so it doesn't really matter what the U.S. does anymore. I mean, it does, of course, but like you said, the show will go on, and it's there will be another country or countries that will emerge as a leader, and a lot of people are talking about China right now as being a potential global leader on climate, sort of taking up the slack from the U.S., which is sort of an amazing change of turn of events over the last 10 years.
Well, China's poised to do that in many other realms besides climate change, and those will probably transcend their role in climate, meaning their involvement in Africa and as a source of resources for China. You know, most nations are still going to approach this, including China and India, with little regard for what Trump or Obama or President Clinton would have done. There's no evidence that India is going to change its mix of domestic choices on energy based on some leadership statement that an American leader will provide. They stuck firm to their doubling of coal, and they need coal. They need electricity more than they need to worry about climate change. And there is a time bomb.
Although they really have to worry about climate change too.
Not nearly as much as energy access.
Well, and air quality. I mean, so they may have to deal with it indirectly because of air quality issues.
Yeah, that's kind of what happened in China, it seems.
Yeah, but much of their air quality is from burning dung. You know, you go to their city emissions. I'll just say that there is a time bomb in Paris, and it's the financial commitments. This idea that the rich countries are going to pay $100 billion to poor ones to help them do their energy transitions and their resilience. There's very little evidence that that's going to happen at the scale of the poor countries' demand, and that could make much more of an impact on the climate process than anything Trump will do.
But still, even still, like, you know, for those of us like Kim and I, you know, in the meantime, who have these research programs that need to go forward and training the next generation of climate scientists and, you know, be involved in, you know, who we've devoted our lives to doing this research and being involved in the national level in climate science. It's like, okay, that's nice, you know, but it keeps me up at night.
Oh, but there's you know, I'm writing this piece right now about NASA and what's going to happen with budgets. And there's a totally solid argument for intensifying the Earth-focused part of NASA's mission and not doing what this Bob Walker, the former House Science Committee chairman from the 90s, is trying to convince Trump to do. But that message has to come pretty loud and clear from many quarters.
It does. And I also want to say, for those of you who are listening who have been following this story kind of from the sidelines and are wondering or have asked yourselves, why the heck is NASA funding Earth-based research? Go back to the late 70s when the idea of space exploration was considered, a little bit, it was aspirational, but not necessarily practical in terms of the on-the-ground needs of everyday Americans. And so Congress gave NASA a mandate to do research in the public good. And that's when they started doing air quality monitoring and climate monitoring and all of these other things, monitoring ozone. And so the fact that NASA is doing this kind of research at all is because Congress asked them to. And so I just wanted to put that out there because facts matter.
In your world, Jacqueline, facts matter, not for the rest of us.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I don't know, there was this really frustrating piece. Kim, you may have seen it in National Review, basically saying that scientists need to stop having public opinions.
I did see that.
Yeah. I don't know. How do you feel about being a scientist?
Jacqueline, I can already see you have like both middle fingers raised right now.
Well, for me, it's just like, I'm just going to ask Kim how she feels about this, because otherwise I'm going to take up the rest of the show.
Yeah, I mean, I think you and I would be very much on the same page about this. There may be certain aspects of science where it's morally okay for you to chew on your results with your 50 best buddies every year at your conference. We do not work in one of those fields. Absolutely, we have, in my view, a moral obligation. And furthermore, how ridiculous it is to assume that if we can somehow cloak the political relevance of our work and hide it in a closet and pretend like it's not there and beat on a table and say, I am objective. It would be completely undoable and morally reprehensible. So I think you and I are on the same page.
Oh, well, yeah, plus many other scientists and me. The key thing is to identify when something is a values-based statement and when something is a science-based statement, whether you're a journalist or a scientist or anybody else. I study sea ice. It's changing. I am a voter and a parent, and I think we need to have a carbon tax. Those are two entirely separate things. And that's, I think, any scientist, there are many scientists. Steve Schneider was really good at this. Gavin Schmidt did a talk at the AGU meeting, the Geophysical Union meeting, about the same thing. Identify your priors, lay them out, tell people what's a fact and what's an opinion, and then go forward. And absolutely, scientists have a right to be a human being too.
Yeah, and it's also a human endeavor because it's done by humans, right? I mean, there's been a lot of research in the humanities, in the disciplines that intersect with science, like the history of science or the philosophy of science. And, you know, those of us who listen to those disciplines can learn a lot about how, you know, who does science affects what questions get asked, how those questions get reported. You know, we have some general sense that who funds science can have an influence on the outcome, which is why it's so important to have publicly funded science, because then, you know, at least you're making your best faith efforts that those results are in the public interest or the public good, and, you know, not in special interests. But, you know, this idea of scientists are somehow exempt from citizenship, that we don't have those same responsibilities and rights as other citizens, I think is silly and perpetuates this false idea that we should just be fact-generating robots. And, you know, I am able to have opinions about the impacts of climate change as a citizen that, you know, that don't influence my science. And acknowledging the sort of advocacy hat, and when that hat is on, and then when I take it off and put my science hat on, I think makes my science more rigorous, and it makes my efforts at objectivity, when that's necessary, you know, much more transparent.
We're going to pause the show here for just a minute to talk about a very cool new product from our sponsor, Arcadia Power. Have you ever thought about going solar, but you can't because you rent or your roof is too shaded? Well, now, for the first time ever, you can reduce your monthly bill with Arcadia Power's Community Solar Program. Arcadia Power is an online renewable energy company that's making solar savings more inclusive to homeowners and renters in 50 states. Arcadia's nationwide community solar program allows anyone who pays a power bill to subscribe to solar panels from projects across the country and get savings on their monthly bill no matter where they live. It only takes a few minutes to subscribe to solar panels online and start saving. Arcadia offers you a modern, personalized solar experience to track everything. Arcadia's dashboard provides real-time solar production monitoring, direct on-bill crediting, and savings analysis. You can also take advantage of energy-saving tips and efficient products to help you lower your bills even more. Learn more about Arcadia's community solar program and find out how much you can save at arcadiapower.com/solar. That's arcadiapower.com/solar.
I've also felt this a little bit because I sort of go back and forth between being a scientist and being a journalist. But for my practical output purposes, I'm mostly a journalist right now. I think that I've struggled with the same thing in terms of this sort of pseudo imposed objectivity where as a journalist, you're supposed to sort of dryly report the story and the facts of what happened. A lot of times what happened is not the facts of the story, is the process of getting up to that point, and that involves people, and people are the more interesting people are more interesting than the facts that they generate in a lot of times. And I see a lot of pushback sometimes from other journalists in how I talk about climate online or even in my own stories, where, you know, of course, writing for Slate really encourages your own opinion, sort of weaves opinion into facts, more so in the way of this is why this is good, this is why this is bad, this is why you should be outraged from this story, rather than I mean, we're not the Associated Press, you know, we have license to sort of say what we feel about something at any given time. I feel like that, I mean, as we move into a fully post-fact world, I think that's important. I mean, you have to be honest to the facts. You have to, you know, we will rigorously correct any story that we publish with an incorrect statement of fact. But at the same time, we have also the ability to place facts in their societal context. And I think that is what really true journalism is right now, is interpreting facts rather than just, you know, like people, a lot of people aren't, you know, PhD climate scientists, so they can't really tell off the cuff of skimming a 300-word story if this new coral bleaching event is somehow different than past coral bleaching events. You know, like, you rely on people that have an informed stake in these stories to sort of say, rank these stories for the reader that has a few minutes a day on climate. How important is this, and why should I care? I think that's the role of the journalist right now.
I also think, though, that by being a journalist who's paying attention to the human angle, especially as it applies to science and the process of science, you're not only making that science story more appealing or more fun or more relatable, but you're also inadvertently giving people a better sense of the process of science and the fact that science is this kind of, you know, back and forth recursive process, and there's uncertainty, and, you know, the peer review process involves a lot of back and forth, and we kind of come back around to ideas over and over again, and that can get lost when the public or when journalists expect, you know, as Kim was saying, this sort of very very solid response, even when there's a lot of uncertainty, and, you know, that can do the public a disservice because it has been used and abused by climate skeptics in a way, because what you can say is, oh, well, you know, this person says this and then this person says that and they can't come to a real agreement. It's like, well, no, that's just the natural process of science. And sometimes things get revised. Sometimes our hypotheses are wrong, or sometimes, you know, a story shifts and changes, which is why consensus is such a big deal. And to get back to, you know, Kim, you were talking earlier about your experiences, you know, seeing the reefs, and for people who might not appreciate just what a big deal this is, like, your emotional response to that in the field will probably hit that story home in a much more profound way than, you know, any kind of objective statement about, you know, variability or the, you know, some statistical rigor about whether or not this is an extreme event or something like that. Like, it's your emotional response that is going to hit home with people.
So just to close out this section on Paris, which has morphed into a section on how do we report truth accurately in a post-truth world, which is also important. Can we get sort of a quick poll on where will we rank Paris in 5 or 10 years from now in the terms of global action on climate, especially now with context of Trump? Like, is Paris more important after Trump, or is it something that will just go sort of to the dustbin of history?
I'm like, I'm so glad Andy's answering this. Okay, Andy, do it.
well, there will be a COP 50 and a COP 51. You know, I guess it's a bead on a string. It's bigger than the other beads. Like Copenhagen was a darkish bead, but actually Copenhagen set the stage for Paris in many ways. There's actually some people making that argument. It wasn't such a disaster. It was the turning point. And it's all...
I mean, some people meaning Hillary Clinton in her argument for being president, which was sort of like trying to twist, you know, like spin gold out of...
Well, yeah, but there's so much interpolation. There's so much interpolation on all sides of these issues. There were never going to be binding targets and timetables. Europe insisted it was going to happen, and it was clear for... I mean, watching this process since before Rio, you know, 1988, my first stories in this, I was going to use the S word.
That's fine.
We're
all friends here.
like most journalists, I'm a show me guy, not a convince me guy. A convince me guy is like in terms of showing me. And, you know, look at the emissions data versus any policy decisions that have been made globally. And you see that the primacy of energy needs, with unfortunately fossil fuels still being the cheapest, most ready source, is just still dominating policy. And the one thing that I wrote, tried to convince people out of Paris that was missing and should be, and whatever comes next, is commitments in the treaty process to advancing energy technologies. You know, it's like just not there. And Susan Solomon and others wrote papers proposing that budgets for R&D should be a commitment that people make in the Paris process. I hope that they are heard.
So the next story, number two, 2016 was the planet Earth's warmest year on record. So this is normally would be quite the story, but I feel like there's so much that's happened this year that this sort of steady, I think it ended at 16 or 17 record months in a row. It seems like it's sort of quickly faded out of our collective memory. But earlier this year, during the peak El Nino, it was crazy. The global temperature anomalies were truly remarkable, far above what I personally expected, but far above, I think, what almost every close observer of the climate system expected. That really, you know, on a 20th, using a 20th century baseline, we got very close to the 1.5 degree C global anomaly in February and March. If you go back to a pre-industrial baseline, like 1850, we passed 1.5 degrees for that period of time during the peak El Nino, and we came very close to 2 degrees C, the global anomaly. And this is just purely hasn't happened before. We're even in a momentary basis, we're getting there. You know, we're getting to that point where we see global systems shift in a nonlinear fashion. And you know, we've already talked a lot about corals as being one impact of that pulse of global warmth earlier this year. But and this also, 2016 will go down as the third consecutive warmest year on record. So where does this rank for you guys on sort of the important climate stories of this year?
Well, for me, it definitely ranks very, very high. I know it was an El Nino year, and that will always cause a dramatic bump in the global average temperatures during that year. And of course, we saw that in 1997 and 1998 as well. And then the interesting thing for me is that it's kind of feels a little bit like a gear shift to me. I wonder where we will be in 3 or 5 years. In 1997, 1998, it was a little bit of a gear shift as well. So we had this huge peak, and then we obviously came back down off that peak, but we kind of stayed at this really warm levels across the 2000s. We were still breaking year by year, in some cases, global average temperature records, even while we had we didn't have any dramatic El Nino events during that time. So to me, I have this a little bit of foreboding sense, like this may be one of those gear shifts again, where we're going to end up flirting with a new temperature record every year or two. And right now, the scary thing is it's really hard for me to think about breaking what will be the new 2016 record, having internalized the new graph of global average temperatures in my head. That's very sobering to me. It feels like a fast forward to 2030 to me.
Wow. Yeah. And I know Gavin Schmidt, who's been a guest on our show before, has run the numbers. And even if you subtract out El Nino, this year still would have been the warmest year on record. So El Nino probably added a tenth or two tenths to that record. But when you're talking about, I mean, if you use the NASA data set, the 1950 to 1980 global average, we're at 1.2 or 1.3 C in February and March. And up until last year, there had never been a month above 1 degree C. So the number one story in the climate system in 2016, as voted on by Twitter, is the really spectacular decline in Arctic sea ice that has continued mostly throughout this entire year. So we've had more days at a record low extent in the Arctic in 2016 than any other year in history. We ended up as the second lowest minimum in September, but really that sort of masks how truly extreme this year has been in the Arctic. And recently, in the last several weeks, the Antarctic as well has been having record low sea ice. For many reasons, scientists don't really pay as close attention to the Antarctic, because it's a lot more changeable based on El Nino. The Arctic is a better signal of sort of long-term climate shifts in, I think, many people's, many scientists' view. And what we're seeing this year is, again, it's a lot different than what's happened before, where as of right now, you know, in early December, there's still large parts of the Arctic, I think, the latest number was like 1.5 Texases that is open water that just a decade or two ago would have been ice. And the reason for this is that the water itself is still too warm to freeze, where in the past it would have been frozen right now. So ice couldn't form really even if it wanted to. You know, the air temperature, of course, is very cold right now, but it takes a lot of cold air to chill warm seawater down to the freezing point. And that's really kind of what we're seeing this year.
It's been remarkable, and it continues to be remarkable. That's what's, you know, there's this delayed freeze up as well. The level of ice even now with the 24-hour darkness and incredible cold is way down. And it's a function of currents and temperature. And as it's got a lot of people scratching their heads. The Antarctic part has people scratching their heads, of course, because the drivers of sea ice change down there are complicated, way, way more complicated, I think, than in the Arctic. And putting those two figures together, some of the sea ice people say it's not even worth thinking about sea ice trends at the two ends of the Earth together because they're so different. But it's a big change. The world's changing, you know, the climate's changing, the cryosphere is changing and expect more of the same. There can be more fluctuations up and down. Marika Holland, a really good modeler at the National Center for Atmospheric Research years ago, I quoted her on the reality that the Arctic is sensitive to little jogs, and those can be in two directions. So it's kind of, you could have more blips in the other direction before mid-century or later having, you know, essentially a fully open Arctic Ocean in late summer. But stay tuned.
Yeah, I really feel like it's going to be sooner than mid-century that you're going to get effectively ice-free Arctic. So we're already down to, I think, it's 4 million square kilometers in September, something like that. And anything below 1 million square kilometers is considered an ice-free Arctic. Because then you have really just a little lump of ice hugging in around northern Canada, the islands in northern Canada, and that's really all there is left at that point. From a climate system standpoint, once there's open water, the water is able to more quickly absorb the short summer heat energy from the sun, and that's when the sort of tipping point sets in where there's a lot of people that are not even really jokingly talking about ice-free winters now. If you have an ocean that is above the point of freezing, you're going to get large sections of the Arctic that, even though it's dark 24 hours a day and it's 40 below, it's going to be ice free because the winter doesn't have enough time to chill that water back down to the freezing point. That's when we're going to start to see some serious change. I mean, we're already seeing serious changes, But that's one of those things that's sort of, I think, not really on people's radar, but is definitely physically possible to happen in our lifetime.
And I'm getting a lot of questions about what the record low sea ice extents are going to mean in terms of our weather. Like, how will we experience that here in North America or in the Northern Hemisphere? And, you know, it's one of those concrete ways in which there's growing evidence that reduced sea ice is something that we are experiencing in as extreme events, that by reducing the temperature gradient between the Arctic and, say, Maine, where I live, there's you're basically sort of weakening the engine that drives our wind patterns. And obviously, Eric, you know more about this than me, but that can cause changes in our storm tracks as you get at these blocking patterns where basically the circulation gets stuck, right? And we've experienced those potentially as things like the polar vortex or, heat waves, or here in the Northeast, drought. I was talking to a reporter from the Christian Science Monitor about how the Northeastern drought has affected the Christmas tree crop this year. And, you know, so these are some of the ways in which, you know, we often talk about on the show how climate change feels very distant for a lot of people, but this is a concrete example of how these atmospheric connections can result in, you know, me in Maine directly experiencing something that is caused by a reduction in sea ice in the Arctic very far away from me right now.
Yeah, the changes on sort of mid-latitude weather as a result of the sea ice decline is still very much a topic of open scientific discussion, but it doesn't mean that, you know, just to circle back around to what Kim was saying earlier, it doesn't mean that just because there's genuine scientific discussion, it doesn't mean that the implications of that possible consequence are sort of invalid. You know, just because we're talking about multiple different possible paths the climate system could take doesn't mean that sort of where the data point potential worst case scenario is not super scary and really relevant to our own daily lives here far from the Arctic.
Yeah, I think that the whole concept of the public having a right to know as the scientific process unfolds and to welcome them into that discussion and to hope that they engage in that process and in witnessing the various studies and listening to scientists discuss it As Jacqueline was saying, you know, science is a process, and they do have a right to know what the key points of these discussions and their implications are.
I think that's a great place to end it. So that's our show for this time, and that will be the end of season one of Warm Regards. If you like what we're doing here, please tell a friend. And as always, please feel free to hit us up with your thoughts on future guests or show ideas or pretty much anything. Our email address is ourwarmregards@gmail.com. And you can follow us on Twitter @ourwarmregards. And, you know, hopefully we will make it all through this next few months together and emerge out on the other end at the start of season two with sort of renewed hope that we all have a part to play in whatever world is ahead of us. So for Jacqueline, Andy, and our guest Kim, and our producer Stephen Lacey, I am Eric Holthaus. Thank you for listening, everybody.
We'd like to thank Arcadia Power for supporting the Warm Regards podcast. Arcadia's game-changing technology platform is giving anyone who pays a power bill the ability to go solar and to save. No need for a rooftop. With Arcadia, you can subscribe to panels nationwide, get savings on your monthly bill, and if you move, your savings will move to your next utility. Reduce your impact and save with Arcadia's Community Solar. Learn more at arcadiapower.com/solar.